Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In 1917, in Fatima, Portugal, three shepherd children claimed that the Virgin Mary appeared before them and spoke the words, "Do not be afraid." Stephen Hannigan first heard the story of Our Lady of Fatima when he was a young boy attending a Catholic school in Texas in the 1950s, struggling to come to grips with a religion that simultaneously soothed and terrified him. The question of what actually happened in Fatima in the early part of the 20th century, one of the most important and most mysterious events in the Church's history, captured his young imagination and has stayed with him ever since. His new book is called Sorrowful Mysteries, The Shepherd Children of Fatima and the Fate of the 20th Century. Stephen Harrigan is author of the New York Times bestseller The Gates of Alamo, Remember Ben Clayton, Challenger Park, A Friend of Mr. Lincoln, Big Wonderful Thing, A History of Texas, and The Leopard is Loose. He's a writer at large for Texas Monthly, as well as a screenwriter who's written many movies for television, lives in Austin, Texas, and he joins us for the program today. Stephen Harrigan, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us.
Sounds great to be here.
So I understand that originally you were just going to write a magazine article about the miracle of the children of Fatima. What changed your mind on that?
What changed my mind was going to Fatima and seeing with my own eyes this remarkable place where 5 million, you know, devout or just curious people flock to every year to learn about what happened there in 1917. And as I wandered around the pilgrimage site, which is now like this vast, you know, complex of basilicas and churches and souvenir shops, I began to think about my own childhood and how deeply enmeshed my own sort of magical thinking as a young Catholic boy was with these children of Fatima, even though we were separated by, you know, 50 years or more. The idea that there were things that bound us together, you know, particularly the rituals of the Catholic Church, the hymns, the prayers, the kind of cosmology, and the belief that there were these beings like the Virgin Mary who might visit us one day and require something of us or tell us something that we needed to know. So it was, I had a kind of deep sense of nostalgia when I visited Fatima, both about the Catholic Church, which I'm kind of, you know, sort of have been trying to leave all my life, but it's not so easy to stop being a Catholic. You know, it's a very grabby religion, you know, and so I just thought there was a lot to explore here, both in terms of the events of Fatima and my own reaction to it and my own sort of, struggles over the years to sort of define myself in reference to my religious upbringing.
In fact, in your acknowledgments, I was struck by this. You thank your wife, this is dedicated to your wife, and you say she's puzzled over the years of your marriage, over this hold, right? You've left
right.
Catholicism, you've left your faith, but it still has a hold on you. And then you muse about how this has maybe affected your daughters.
Yeah, I mean, I think anybody, like anyone who grew up like I did in a devout Catholic family in mid-century America, 20th century, will understand the kind of complexity of growing up in that faith, growing out of it, you know, feeling drawn back to the rituals and the culture of it, and for my own family, my wife Sue Ellen grew up in West Texas and a, you know, in a Baptist and Episcopal background, there's just a difference. There's a difference between that kind of upbringing that she had and the kind I had, which was not, you know, radical or anything, but it was submersive, you know, immersive. I mean, it inhabited every aspect of our lives. You know, we said the family rosary every night. We went to church every Sunday. We observed every feast day. So, and I went to Catholic school for 12 years. So, it's been a lifelong project trying to explain to my wife who I am in the sense of that of that kind of Catholic, that deep Catholic background.
And this journey, I guess you're trying to explain to yourself as well. You're trying to come to terms with this.
Yeah, exactly. And Fatima is the lens through which I'm trying to do this, both for the readers for whom I think the story of Fatima would be fascinating on its own, and for those like me who have a complicated relationship with Catholicism, or for people who have no understanding or background in Catholicism, but are curious about it and curious about what it was like to grow up in that context at that particular time.
You write that speaking of your, I think at this point you're in Abilene, a young kid. You say for Catholic children those days, being visited by the Virgin Mary was the closest thing to discovering you had a superpower. And Catholicism was a feverish religion that helped inflame a child's already wild imaginings. So when did you, I guess you remember when you, or at least the approximate time you first learned of Our Lady of Fatima?
Yeah, I think when we first learned about it, we went to a Catholic school in Abilene, Texas, and the nuns showed us a movie called The Miracle of Our Lady of Fatima with Gilbert Rowland. And that was again, we were suffused with this imagery and with this expectation of supernatural events. And so that movie sort of confirmed it, that it was possible to be visited by the Virgin Mary or by other entities. And then later in that decade, the 1950s, we were told that, you know, the story is that there were three children in 1917, Lucia Santos and her two cousins, Francisco and Jacinta Marto. Lucia was 10, Francisco was 8, and Jacinta was 7. They said that in a field where they were grazing their sheep, the Virgin Mary appeared to them on May 13th, 1917, the first of 6 apparitions. And it became a huge, gigantic series of events, concluding in what many people believe is a miraculous occurrence on the 6th apparition. And one of the things that Lucia did when she later became a nun was write a letter, which is known as the Third Secret of Fatima, known to us as the Fatima Letter at that time, in which we were told by the nuns who taught us in Catholic school, this would, Lucia had said, Sister Lucia by that time, had said it could only be opened in 1960. And we were made to understand that it would foretell the fate of the world. And you have to remember, you know, 1959, 1960, that time, the height of the Cold War, coming up under the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, a sense of terror in the air all the time. Children were being told to, you know, hide under their desk if the hydrogen bomb started falling. And so we lived in this, you know, an atmosphere of deep fear and deep religious belief. And when the, when 1960 came, we asked the nuns, I think Sister Martha at that time, who was teaching us, what did the letter say? Because we were deeply concerned. And she said, oh, that the Pope read it, thought it was too horrible for anybody to read, and put it back in the envelope and sealed it up. And so that only increased our terror and our sense of doom. And so the curiosity that I and the rest of the world felt about the contents of that letter just began magnifying over the decades.
Yeah, I guess the fact that it was a mystery still. Added to the fear, I suppose. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the Catholicism or any religion is a mystery. You know, it's a matter of faith. It's a matter of belief. And, you know, that the lingering sense of what if or what could happen or what is the world about and who are we? I mean, those were all part of what was, you know, the Fatima experience for a lot of us.
So you say the learning the story of Fatima And the original message of the Virgin Mary was, do not be afraid. You had terror, but you also were soothed. Tell me about that dichotomy.
Well, exactly, because, in the cosmology of Catholicism, the Virgin Mary is the mother figure. She is the soothing figure, the one who tells you it's going to be okay. She's the intercessor to, perhaps in many people's minds, a less forgiving or a more judgmental God. And so it's no accident that people throughout the world, particularly Latin America, as witnessed by the Virgin of Guadalupe, whose image is everywhere throughout Latin America, Mexico, she is like the figure that, she's the most human figure in Catholicism. She's the most approachable. And so it's no accident, I think, that a 10-year-old girl who had a troubled home life, who lived in a very troubled part of the world in 1917, where Catholicism was being repressed by a Portuguese Republican government, a secular government, she would turn, she would imagine, I think, and to the devout, she didn't imagine it. It actually happened, but in my mind, she probably fantasized this image of the Virgin Mary appearing to her and calm, trying to calm her fears.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. The three of them, Lucia lived to be 97, I think, became a nun. I'll get into some of her history, which is fascinating. The other two, tell me about the other two who died in the flu epidemic.
Yeah, and this is another reason I was so drawn to the story, because I started thinking about writing this, a year or so after COVID, or after, COVID started to, became less threatening. So we had all lived through a pandemic, and we had all learned, I think many of us, about the 1918 flu pandemic that killed so many people around the world. And, the events of Fatima happened in 1917, from May to October of 1917. And then that next year, the flu hit. And it attacked, unlike COVID, it attacked young people. And two of the young people it attacked were Francisco and his sister Jacinta, who were Lucia's cousins. And most of what we know about their deaths comes from Lucia's later recollections in a series of memoirs she wrote. And again, she was extremely devout. And if you read about the deaths of these children, which are horrible, but in their minds as interpreted by Lucia, they were totally at peace, because they believed that the Virgin Mary had told them they were going to die, they were going to go to heaven, they would be happy forever. So whether that's true or not, whether they really felt that way, it's hard to know. But one thing it's not hard to imagine is the terror these children felt and the pain they endured. And I went to the hospital where Jacinta died in Lisbon. I visited the little village in outside of Fatima, where all the children grew up, and I saw the room where Francisco died, and the sense of empathy and sorrow you feel at recognizing what happened to these children, and their belief that they didn't have to be afraid. is so touching and so powerful. So it's hard not to go to these places and not feel that the power of that, of their religious faith.
I think the Virgin Mary told them, or invited them, are you willing to suffer? You will need to suffer, but then you'll go to heaven. Right. I also understand she told Francisco he'd have to do some rosaries or something. He'd have to do a little extra work to get in. Yeah,
I think because he was a boy.
Okay.
I think this is a kind of girls' club, and Francisco was the only one who supposedly cannot hear the Virgin Mary, And so, yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's harder for boys to get to heaven, I think, is one of the takeaways from this story.
So that original pairing, maybe we could set the scene a little bit. She appeared above a tree, I think, a young tree. Tell us about the setting.
Okay, so these three children lived in this village called Aljustrel, which is, you know, about a mile or so from Fatima today. And they grazed the family sheep on this place called the Cova da Iria, this little sort of hollowed area, you know, field. And they were saying the rosary one day. And what Lucius said was that a young woman sort of floated down onto the top of this sort of stunted oak tree and began this conversation with them. She didn't immediately reveal who she was, but it was pretty obvious. And so she came down, she appeared on the 13th of May in 1917, May being the month of our mother, the month of the Virgin Mary. She came back, she promised to come back on each month, on the same day each month for 6 months. On the sixth month, the sixth apparition, she had promised a miracle. And by this time, there were maybe 300,000 people in that field. The family's, Santos family's income was based upon that field, and it was all churned up into mud. So the family was having lots of difficulties, financial and otherwise. So there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and it had been raining. It was raining hard that day. The sky suddenly cleared. There was a brightness and sheen in the air. The sun looked like a flat disk, and to many of those who were there, they believed they saw the sun dancing in the sky. It's called the miracle of the sun, and so that was sort of the promise that the Virgin had made to perform a miracle. And whether that actually occurred, you know, there's lots of speculation about what kind of atmospheric effects might have been happening at that time. Not everyone who was there apparently saw it, because, you know, many people reported seeing it, but many more people did not report it at all. So we don't know for sure. But it was a very powerful experience for those who were there. And that site is now, that field is now the site of the Fatima pilgrimage site. Mm.
How quickly did it become a place of pilgrimage? Immediately after that October miracle?
Yeah, I would say after about the second apparition in June, about 50 people showed up for the second apparition, and then word got around. And again, remember, this was a time when you had all these people. This is a remote place. It was a village way up in the kind of hill country of Portugal, you know, northwest of Lisbon. And it had just, you know, it was a tumultuous time. Portugal was embroiled in the First World War. 100,000 men, Portuguese men, were off fighting either on the Western Front or elsewhere. And there was a lot of political turmoil. It was making a violent transition from a monarchy to a republic. There was a lot of suppression of Catholicism. So all these people, who many of whom were illiterate but very deeply religious, wanted reassurance, wanted to know that their faith was not in peril, that their visions were true. And so everyone was primed, I think, to see this event and to reflect on it.
Well, let's take a brief break. We'll come back with much more of Stephen Harrigan. The latest book is Sorrowful Mysteries, The Shepherd Children of Fatima and the Fate of the 20th Century. We'll have more following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the author Stephen Harrigan. His latest book, out and available now, fascinating book, Sorrowful Mysteries, The Shepherd Children of Fatima and the Fate of the 20th Century. So, Stephen Harrigan, you You did a deep dive into, especially to Lucia, right? Fascinating figure. And the other two might have been, but they died so young.
Right.
So, but the general reaction, I think there was a lot of belief, right? But skepticism, sure, as well. Tell me about the her family. I guess people came and flooded, so to speak, the field, their livelihood. So this can't have been popular within her own family.
That's right. I mean, Lucia's mother in particular was extremely skeptical of these events, of this, the fact that her child had seen the Virgin Mary. And she brought a lot of, you know, this brought so much trouble to the family, because again, that family, like all families in Portugal at that time, Catholic families were caught between, a kind of overbearing secular government and their traditional Catholic way of life. And her mother did not want her to make waves. Also, I think she was a 10-year-old girl. I mean, 10-year-old girl, I have 10-year-old granddaughters. I was a 10-year-old boy. I have 10-year-old daughters. I understand the imaginative range that your mind has at that age. And so I think her mother probably, as any mother would not accept this at face value when their child comes home and says, oh, I saw the Virgin Mary, or I saw an angel, or I saw a fairy, or whatever. I mean, you would just be skeptical. But it was the kind of thing, Lucy, I think, was such an imaginative child and such a determined child that she wouldn't let it go. That created big problems for the family. It ruined their livelihood. I mean, their livelihood was completely dependent on that grazing land and on the crops they planted. Her father started drinking. Her other siblings left the house, so it was just sort of her and her mother and her troubled father. And from Lucia's descriptions, it sounds like, I think she says this, but where had all the joy in our house gone? You know, and she blamed herself. You know, I mean, she didn't, she thought she was doing the work of the Virgin Mary, but she knew that it was because of her that these problems beset the family. And she became a celebrity, you know, at a time when that was very troubling and complicated. And she was actually sent off by the bishop off to school in Porto, basically to get her out of town, because she was, once she hit puberty, I think she might start, no telling what she would say or how she would act. And that would have an effect on her, on whether people believed her story or not, or if she even believed it anymore. So I think they wanted to kind of hustle her out of town, get her to off to a safe, religious school. But she never, ever once doubted herself, doubted what she had seen. In fact, she had more visions when she was a young novitiate in Spain. And so all through her life, she was extremely devout, extremely determined, never wavering. As you said earlier, lived to be 97 years old. And, her cousins, her young cousins died when they were, I think, 10 and 11, or maybe, I think, no, 9 and 10. So she outlived them by 80-some, almost 90 years. Hmm.
What kind of life did she want? I guess, I don't know whether she chose the convent or that was a good solution, but she accepted it, I guess. But as she went along, you're right that she wanted more and more solitude, it sounded like. She wanted to become a Carmelite.
Yeah, she wanted to be a cloistered Carmelite nun.
Yeah.
And, she was a young girl and then a woman who, I mean, it's the equivalent of like growing up as a child celebrity today, I think. She was harassed, interrogated relentlessly by priests and not just priests, but by hostile secular authorities, one of whom kidnapped her and the other two kids at some point during this summer these things happened. And I think solitude was her refuge, and she she had a, I think she had a lingering need to be understood and to be appreciated, and within the church in particular. But she really was seeking that life of solitude where she could just pray and think and be away from all the clamor she had experienced as a young girl.
There, I think you visited a museum. There's a museum, I think.
Yeah, there are many museums.
Many museums, okay.
Yeah, but yeah. One of the ones, you may be referencing the one in Coimbra where the Carmelite convent is, in which Lucia spent. She went into that convent in 1948, the year I was born, and lived there the rest of her life. And you can go to this little museum to her life, devoted to her life, and you can see the artifacts there. You can see her cell or a replica of the cell she lived in, you know. And it's very moving, you know, to think of this woman who had been a young girl, who had these events not happened, she would have probably gotten married and, you know, had children, and, you know, life would have gone on, you know, as most lives did back then. But there was this amazing, road that she took, you know, where she, because of her imagination, I think, and others would say because of the Virgin Mary actually visiting her, her life took a radically different turn. And, so you go to that museum and you see the place she lived, you see the suitcase that her mother gave her when she went off to school that she kept for the rest of her life, all these very touching artifacts of this poor little village girl, illiterate girl at the time, who in some ways changed the world.
Mm-hmm. I think you visited her cell where she lived, right?
That's part of the museum.
Yeah.
And I visited, of course, the house where she lived in El Justro. That's a little tiny village. It's just, it's a hard scrabble world. You know, the Portugal and the early 20th century, those mountain villages in Portugal. I mean, she was, like I say, like 92% of the female population in that part of Portugal at that time was illiterate. So their culture was Catholicism and this kind of, and a certain mystical belief in these ethereal beings like the Virgin Mary.
So we do get a bit of a sense of her personality a little bit. Lucia, she was cloistered, of course, but people would go and visit her. There's one visit that struck me that you have in the book, this priest who's also a sculptor. He's going to sculpt a large sculpture of the original miracle of Fatima, and she tells him, "Well, you got this wrong, you got that wrong." There's a back and forth. She still has the memory.
Yeah, she's a tough critic. You know, he was supposed to create a statue of the Virgin Mary as she appeared to Lucia. That's now, you can now see at the Basilica of Fatima. And a very huge statue, many tons, heavy. And he was, I think he was, the sculptor was taken aback by, I don't know if he was expecting praise. Yet he brought in a little model, and she just went right at it and said, "No, that's wrong. Do this, do this, do that." And she was tough-minded, you know. She was, I think that's part of living in isolation in a convent. I mean, I don't think and also the older she got, probably the less small talk she needed, the less, you know, she didn't need to please anybody anymore. She just needed to tell what she thought was true. And so you get the sense that she was fun to be around at times, but would not shy from correcting you if she thought you were, you know, doing it the wrong way.
And devout all her life, I guess, a believer.
Oh, absolutely.
All her life. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I want to talk about the letter. This was, she wrote this 1944, well into her life.
Absolutely. And reluctantly, she didn't want to write it, but her bishop ordered her to write it down, or asked her to strongly. And there were three secrets that the children said that the Virgin Mary confided in them. One was a vision of hell. One was a kind of a prophecy of what would happen if Russia was not converted to Catholicism and there would be more wars, like World War II. And the third was the one that they would never reveal, that Lucia said could never be revealed. That was the third secret of Fatima. That was what everybody wanted to know. And that was finally what the bishop asked her to write down in a document. And she had almost died from various ailments and was kind of recovering from that and felt like it was time. I think she felt like the Virgin Mary had given her permission to write this down. So she wrote what's called the third secret of Fatima, also what we knew as the Fatima letter when we heard about it and as children. And she gave it to the bishop, who then passed it on to the Vatican. It was supposed to be opened in 1960. That's what she wrote on the outside of the envelope. And when they opened it, this Pope John Paul XXIII thought, don't want anything to do with this, because he was in the middle of trying to reform the Catholic Church. And this was kind of like a medieval sort of vision, you know. And what the letter said when it was finally opened or revealed to the public in 2000 was, it's a kind of vision of an apocalyptic landscape. I mean, and the Pope being murdered, gunned down by assassins. And the reason it was so relevant was that on the 64th anniversary of the first apparition of Fatima, Pope John Paul II was shot down in St. Peter's Square by an assassin. And he survived, but he believed that it was the Virgin Mary who had saved his life by guiding the path of the bullet. And he later gave that bullet to the bishop of, I think, of Liera, who had it. There was a statue of the Virgin of Fatima. It's a very famous statue with this beautiful golden crown made by these famous jewelers in Lisbon. And the Pope gave them the bullet, and it was welded into the crown of Our Lady of Fatima statue, which you can see it today at the Fatima Museum. So the connection with all these events of the 20th century, like assassinations, is very profound, I think.
So this landed about 2000s when the text was released, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
So for some, it would have confirmed maybe their faith and belief. For others, it would be anticlimactic.
I think for most people, it was anticlimactic. For some, very conservative, traditionalist, right-wing Catholic theorist, it was proof that the Vatican was hiding something, that there had to be more. And I think for Pope Benedict, the cardinal who later became Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger, acknowledged that people might be disappointed in this, and that it tried to sort of spin it in a way that was kind of metaphorical and not to be taken literally. But it was kind of a big letdown, and you could understand why the Pope back in 1960, John the 23rd, would not want it revealed, because it was out of sync with where the church was going. So it's a very complicated, interdoctrinal dispute about what the Fatima letter is all about, what it means, whether there's not just a third secret, but a fourth secret that's hidden in the Vatican archives somewhere. Like everything, everything these days, it seems to spawn a conspiracy. But I think it's probably just basically that's what the letter said. And, Lucia wrote it down in a kind of, ecstatic state. And, who knows what the actual words that the Virgin Mary spoke to her and 1917 were, but this is what she recorded her saying.
It's interesting that it depends on what prism you're viewing this through, right? If it, right. Kind of the skeptical view is, no matter what evidence pops up, that's a moving target, right? It's a whack-a-mole. Those who believe are going to come up with some other conspiracy. I guess right, the yeah. unskeptical view is this is the prism of faith, right?
Exactly.
You're believing, but. But this has entered that realm, right? The whole experience at Fatima.
It has. And what's interesting about Fatima to me is it's such a broad spectrum experience. I mean, you could be an absolute atheist and you could be the most devout, Catholic in the world. You could both come to Fatima and feel deeply moved and understand in some way the power that this place has. It's a kind of it's a testament to faith, in human faith, whether you believe in the, and I'm a skeptic, I'm not a devout Catholic as I was when I was a kid, but it's not possible to go there and not be overcome with emotion and to feel the power of the faith that animated so many people for so many centuries. And whether you take that faith literally or metaphorically, or don't take it one way or the other, you're still witnessing a human story, a story about, and to me, what's most powerful is it's a story about children, their imagination, their beliefs, their fears, their hopes, their dreams. And in the case of Francisco and Jacinta, their deaths. And in the case of Lucia, a long and complicated life. And those things are just very, that's what drew me into the story. And was also a way to sort of investigate myself and ask of myself, what do I believe? What do I not believe? Why do I not believe it? What were the expectations that were put on me as a kid growing up in a Catholic world? How could I define myself as a human being outside those expectations and still have a value system that matters to me. So it's a big ball of wax for me as a writer to try to contain all this stuff in one book.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with a brief final segment with Stephen Harrigan. His latest book is available now. It's called Sorrowful Mysteries, The Shepherd Children of Fatima and the Fate of the 20th Century. We'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Stephen Harrigan. His latest book is out and available now. It's called Sorrowful Mysteries, The Shepherd Children of Fatima and the Fate of the 20th Century. So, Stephen Harrigan, you were talking just before the break. I want to explore that just a little bit more. I didn't want to. So you had an intense experience growing up Catholic as a boy, right? And no longer practicing Catholic. I want to read something from the book. So quoting Stephen Harrigan here, but there's still something, still some phantom need to belong to something I can no longer belong to, along with a nostalgia for someone I can no longer be. An innermost Catholic self that can neither be thoroughly expelled nor honestly embraced. It was that sense of unfinished business that led me back to Fatima. And of course, you wrestle with this in the book. Where are you now in terms of that unfinished business? That could be a long answer, but to what to in a nutshell.
The long answer is the book, I think, in some ways, me trying to like come to some sort of conclusion about that. I kind of identify, I realized as I was writing this book that what I am is a non-believing, non-practicing Catholic, which might be a contradiction in many terms, but it to me, Catholicism, I mean, I think anyone who grows up saturated with any particular religion, there's a cultural component to that. There's almost a genetic component to it. So for all that to disappear from your imagination, from your sense of yourself is almost impossible. So what I've come to terms with and feel very comfortable with is that many of the values that were inspired to me by Catholicism are that's who I am. You know, I don't have to believe, I don't believe a lot of what I was taught specifically about the doctrine, but I take seriously who I'm supposed to be because of that set of values. And so I don't miss the terror I felt at growing up as a child, feeling that I was going to go to hell, and that, you know, feeling a sense of shame at, you know, things like sex and things like that. But I do embrace the Sermon on the Mount, and, you know, things, you know, the basic tenets of Christianity, which is, you know, be basically love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, that can't, I don't see how you can go much wrong with that. So that's kind of where I am. I mean, I'm a non-believing believer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. just a couple minutes left. I want to just read another short passage. It's from near the end of the book. You're in Fatima. So I'll just quote this. Nobody in Fatima is thinking about the third secret. Alexander Marto Pereira, owner of the Estrella, the hotel I was staying in, told me one night over dinner. They just feel good here. They like to pray. They're searching not only for peace in the world, they're searching for internal peace. You think that's what most people who go to Fatima now are just, they're not thinking about the letter or the third secret?
I think very few of them. I think he's right there, the person I was interviewing. I think very few people have any particular interest in the letter, in the third secret, in the controversies over the third secret. They're there to feel the presence of, in some cases, literally the Virgin Mary, in some cases of a sense of comfort and belief, and the sense that there is something larger than ourselves, that humankind is aspiring to discover and name. And I think that, you know, that's universal. I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't feel a sense of awe at one point or another in their lives. You know, look at the nighttime sky or a sunset, or, you know, look at photos of the universe. I mean, how could you not believe that there's something larger? The idea that we don't have to name that thing or give a story.
Well, it looks like we're losing the connection here. It's freezing up. So we have been talking with Stephen Harrigan. Your audio cut out just a little bit there, but I think
we caught most of it there. Yeah. Where it's not quite stable.
Yeah, but I think we caught most of that there. So the book is Sorrowful Mysteries, The Shepherd Children of Fatima and the Fate of the 20th Century. Fascinating book, out and available now. Stephen Harrigan, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. A great conversation with you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
And now, commentary from Skywatcher Leo T.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. This short radio program, podcast, and newspaper piece in The Insider in Wayne and Garfield County, Utah, is about the magic of the skies during the day and the night, what's happening in outer space, in exploration, and from our home planet, and how cultures from around the world view the night skies and all of our myths and legends. That's what we all have in common. And I keep true to this without political commentary as much as possible, but I feel it is my duty to not be silent as Congress passes laws, no matter how twisted, that endorse cuts of principles that people in this country have fought and died for and still are, as executive orders that include extraction and shrinking of public lands, national parks, science programs, and many others across the board, slashing of funds to public and community radio and television, as our elected officials slash jobs and funding at NASA, JPL, and its contractors and universities who lead environmental and science studies. It becomes impossible to ignore and simply pretend nothing is happening as we look up at the skies of our beautiful planet as our thriving democracy fades rapidly. Many of today's modern journalists are also held responsible for this travesty. For my broadcasting law classes at the University of Wyoming, I learned that news reporters are responsible to study, take notes, and confirm sources before airing or printing news. Social media is not news, it's a tool. But many broadcast outlets have traded journalistic integrity for innuendo and flashy rumors or sugary pap. Giant media companies buy up networks or they give in to the pressure. Journalists have a responsibility to defend democratic and journalistic principles. Walter Cronkite wrote, and I paraphrase here, that if news reporters give in to overt commercialism, political pressures, and many other undermining factors, we lose democracy. This is in his book titled, A Reporter's Life. Get a copy at the library while you still can. Radio and television outlets and what remains of print journalism as well as online newsletters in this time need not to be completely neutral but constructively critical enough to dig into what's going on. This takeover didn't happen overnight and it won't be cured overnight, but public and community radio and PBS and newspapers are crucial for all of us to have independent thought, creativity, education, and programs of many facets. Whew, okay. Let's have some happiness. Let's have some fun. We have to smell the jasmine and the iris and the roses, enjoy the birds singing in the skies of Earth. I can report that as the climatic summer turns into astronomical summer, as the temperatures rise, we still have nature around us, and we can take a hike, and when it turns to dusk, and then to nighttime, we can look at the jewels in the sky for wonder, magic. Arcturus still comes up. The moon tours through the planets and constellations on its own path, giving us tides and life. Lots of friends and neighbors are talking about the full strawberry moon in June, which is named by Native American tribes. That is the month when some Native American tribes start harvesting wild strawberries. June's full strawberry moon lit up the night sky, last night being June 10th and June 11th. It's going to do the same thing here for a couple of nights. At least it's going to be a huge moon low on the southeastern horizon, going further west every night and rising a little bit later. Sky watchers were treated to a rare once in an 18 and a half year display as it rode across the southern horizon. I saw it out of my bedroom window, very low and huge and magical. A reminder that life and the eternal tides of the universe go on around us. This thanks in part to a quirk of orbital mechanics known to astronomers as a major lunar standstill. This phenomenon occurs over a two-year period when the moon's tilted orbit is at its greatest inclination relative to our planet's celestial equator. This year's June strawberry moon occurs close to the strawberry summer solstice, and even the following nights, the huge moon's fun to watch, huge and low across the tree line. And as we move toward the summer solstice on June 20th, we look forward to the Star Party, Skywatcher Leo T Star Party, June 21st, with Spock and Slass, which starts at dusk or before at the Stansbury Park Observatory Complex in Stansbury in the Tooele area. Come and join us with the friendly star guides from Salt Lake Astronomical Society and their stories in deep space telescopes. And we'll do some star parties down by the Escalante and Capitol Reef and Moab as well, and maybe one in Wyoming. Keep public and community broadcasting alive. Look around and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.